TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. The Global Dominance Group and 9/11. The leadership class in the U.S. is now dominated by a neoconservative group of people with the shared goal of asserting U.S. military power worldwide. This global dominance group, in cooperation with major military contractors, has become a powerful force in world military affairs and U.S. political processes. This is a presentation by Dr. Peter Phillips, Director of Project Censored, at the 9/11 Education and Strategy Conference held in Chicago on June 4, 2006. His talk is based on recent research conducted at Sonoma State University, which identifies 240 global dominance advocates. They have been the primary promoters and beneficiaries of the so-called War on Terror, before and after 9/11. This study examines how interlocking public-private partnerships, including the corporate media, public relations firms, military contractors, policy elites, and government officials, jointly support the U.S. military global domination agenda. In the context of TUC radio programming, this is a long-awaited and very important extension of the work of Alex Carey. The late Australian sociologist had left behind a seminal manuscript on corporate propaganda and the emergence of the neoconservative movement in the U.S. under Ronald Reagan. Alex Carey had been the first to describe the roles that public relations agencies such as Hill and Knowlton and think tanks such as the American Enterprise Institute or the Business Roundtable played in asserting corporate power. He wrote that the 20th century is marked by three historic developments of great importance: the growth of democracy via the expansion of the franchise, the growth of corporations, and the growth of propaganda to protect corporations from democracy. Project Censored's work on the Global Dominance Group, while naming many of the same corporations, media and public relations firms, takes the rise of the neoconservative movement forward from the Reagan era to the George W. Bush administration. They explain how the ambitions of the neocons have grown to include the so-called War on Terror and global military hegemony. Here is Dr. Peter Phillips.
I'm director of Project Censored, and we're a media research group that for 30 years is putting out a list of the most important news stories that the corporate media hasn't covered. So that got us interested in 9/11 unanswered questions right away. Our book in 2003, which came out actually just about a year after 9/11, listed everything that we'd seen at that point that looked like very serious, well-documented, unanswered questions. And we took that even further last year in our book, which is the one that's out right now, 2006. This has a full chapter, Unanswered Questions of 9/11, and it talks about odd as money and Building 7 and all of those things, most of which they're pretty familiar with. One thing that became interesting to me early on and fit into the kind of research I do, I do political research about power elites and have looked at higher class policy councils and groups in the U.S. who kind of are the decision makers, the ones making the decisions in the United States. And I've traced their histories and looked at a long 100-year history of post-industrialization and policy councils, and going back to the, you know, national manufacturers and then the Trilateral Commission, all these different groups. And they're all interesting. They're all elite policy planning groups. But what's happened relative to 9/11 and before is a significant shift in the power base within the policy groups in the United States. So we started kind of a network analysis where we take a look at who the beneficiaries are from 9/11, who were the advocates before. We look at the history of the neocons, and we put together a list, which is available here, and it's on our website at projectcensored.org, of 240 key players in what we call the Global Dominance Group. And the Global Dominance Group is somewhat different, because after the collapse of the Berlin Wall and the deterioration of the Soviet Union, this whole fear of communism, which had galvanized the policy elites in this country since World War II, went away rather quickly. And there was a real push at that time to decide, well, where do we go from here, and what have been our strategies? Our strategy has always been detente, mutually assured destruction between the Soviet Union and the U.S., statesmanship and that. And thus, so we see an emergence then where the leadership class in the United States becomes dominated by a neoconservative group of people who have a shared goal of aggressively asserting U.S. military power worldwide. So our research identifies the key actors in this global dominance group, examines how they are interconnected, how they are supported by the corporate media, and how these key newsmakers use public relation firms to put their agendas out. And we review who benefited from after 9/11, and we examine how Bush, Cheney, and Rumsfeld as the most public figures of this group, but how they're interlocked in public-private partnerships with the corporate media, with private foundations, the military contractors, policy elites, government officials, and that collectively, in a very tight group, they support the U.S. military global domination of the world. And so this is why we call them Global Dominance Group. Now, Wolfowitz, Alan Bloom, Richard Perle, they came out of Chicago's Committee on Social Thought, Leo Strauss, and had this neoconservative philosophy, but they were few in number. But the philosophy is somewhat interesting. I want to give some examples of that. Adbusters magazine defined neoconservatism as the belief that democracy is best defended by an ignorant public pumped up on nationalism and religion. And only a militantly nationalist state can deter human aggression. And such a nationalism requires an external threat, and if one cannot be found, it must be manufactured. So this belief, that the people of the country will go along with and want to defend our nationalism is very present. And John Pilger wrote, he had actually interviewed Richard Perle back during the Reagan administration. And this is his quote. He said, "I interviewed Perle when he was advising Reagan. And he spoke about total war." This was back then. "And I mistakenly dismissed him as mad." He was writing this about 2 years ago. And he said, "And recently he used the term in describing America's war on terror. No stages," Perle said. "This is total war. We're fighting a variety of enemies. There are lots of them out there. All this talk about we're going to do Afghanistan, then we'll do Iraq, and it's entirely wrong. We just let our vision of the world go forth. We embrace it entirely. We don't try to piece together clever diplomacy. We just wage total war. Our children will sing great songs about us in the future." So that's Perle. 10 years ago, during the Reagan administration. So clearly within that, and when Bush was elected to presidency, then Cheney became Secretary of Defense, Bush the first. And so the expansion, the neoconservatives were starting to be placed in power, in positions of power within the government, within Bush the first administration. And by 92, Cheney, using Lewis Livy and Paul Wolfowitz and other writers, had produced what was called the Defense Planning Guidance Document. And this was an internal memorandum circulated with the Pentagon and in high government officials that advocated the U.S. military dominance of the globe in a new world order. That's when that terminology first started. Now, if you remember Bush talking about a new world order back during Gulf War I, that was kind of the origin of it, this new world order, U.S. military, to dominate the world. And it called for the words we hear today: unilateral action, forward presence of troops worldwide, and the U.S. was to dominate friends and foes alike, so that we'd be stronger, literally, militarily, than anybody else in the world. Even if they're our friends, you know, you don't know that, you know, maybe the French next year won't go along with what we want. I mean, so anybody, we needed to be stronger so that we could threaten literally anybody in the world. Well, the defense policy guidance document was leaked to the press. And, you know, and people were kind of in shock about it. The New York Times wrote on March 11th, 92, that senior White House and State Department officials have harshly criticized a draft Pentagon policy statement that asserts America's mission in the post-war era to prevent any collective friendly or unfriendly nations from competing with the United States for superpower status. So the New York Times is saying, hey, this isn't a good idea. Bush kind of backs off on that as a strategy. And then, of course, Clinton, who was never supposed to get elected, got elected. And so these guys are basically out of government. There were some neocons, Woolsey and others, within the Clinton administration, but there wasn't a predominant thing. So Clinton kind of stays away from promoting global dominance as an ideological justification for continued high defense budgets. Remember, in the early 90s, there was this talk of, you know, Cold War dividend, you know, that we were going to have money for schools and for the economy, and that didn't last very long. But, you know, the defense spending went down a little bit. It dipped a little bit. And Cheney had actually did that. It was symbolic. But we see kind of a maintenance. But Clinton's strategy for helping the defense contractors at that time was to actively pursue the expansion of U.S. weapons sales worldwide. So we went from 16% of the international weapons sales in 1988 to 63% in 97. Remember Ron Brown before they got his airplane? And I mean, he was going around promoting arms sales for the defense contractors all over the world. The neoconservatives, you know, they were still very active during the Clinton administration, but most of them ended up in various conservative think tanks or working for Department of Defense contractors. So they moved into the Heritage Foundation, the American Enterprise Institute, the Hoover Institute, GENSA, the Jewish Institute for National Security, Center for Security Policy, and others. And so they're employed there. They're working, writing papers, and doing advocacy for the continued military New World Order advocates. And then, you know, AEI and some other core foundations, American Enterprise Institute, funded the Project for New American Century to kind of galvanize some of this energy in June of 97. So their founding statements, principal statements, kind of reads like a kind of a neocon, you know, world philosophy. We need to increase defense spending. That's kind of core idea number one. To carry out our global responsibilities, we need to strengthen our ties with allies and to challenge regimes hostile to us. We need to promote the cause of political and economic freedom abroad. And we need to accept responsibility for America's unique role in preserving and extending the international order friendly to our security, prosperity, and principles. So this is, you know, protect American corporations anywhere in the world, essentially. And it was kind of this declaration. So when PNAC is founded, there was 25 people who signed that original statement of what they were about. Elliot Abrams, Gary Bauer, Jeb Bush, Cheney, Ilya Cohen, Calizad, Libby, Dan Quayle, Wolfowitz, Rumsfeld, some of the names we know publicly now. But, you know, there was 25 people. 12 of them went right into positions with Bush the second. And so they were lining up, they were ready, and that. It took them 3 years to put out the defense strategies for Resource for New Century. That's a document that is often referenced, as PNAC's document, the Strategy for a New America Defense. That came out in September of 2000. But they put a number of other policy statements out in that time period and were very active. What's interesting is they're interconnected with the, you know, a dozen key policy groups in the country. So this was a new group formed, but it was coming together with energy from a variety of sources. So it wasn't just these 25 guys getting together and say it's time to do this. So The defense policy guidance document was actually written by Libby and Wolfowitz in 92. It looks very much like what came out of the PNAC in 2000. I mean, some of the language is the same. They use some of the same kinds of adjectives and verbs. And the PNAC one was Steve Carbone was in on that, and a number of others who went on to have high positions in the current administration. So that rebuilding American defenses called for homeland protection. We start to get that use of the word homeland, homeland security, homeland protection. The ability to wage simultaneous wars anywhere in the world, to have a global policing role. In other words, we're going to be the police force for the world. To be able to control space, weapons in space, the weaponization of space, and to be able to make those kinds of, literally, I mean, they would love to be able to melt Gaddafi as he was giving a speech somewhere with a satellite beam, you know. And they still have these visions of that kind of Star Wars, weapon control, better than anybody else has got. You know, we see the drones and we see that kind of stuff, and that's kind of the beginning. But they have this technology dream. And they also want to control cyberspace. And they just said that right away. I mean, they want to be able to control the information flow in the internet and that around the world. And then they said that the 90s was a decade of neglect, and the U.S. must increase its military power to preserve a Pax Americana. In other words, we're going to impose peace on the world, and we're going to do that militarily. So we've got 700 bases with forward deployment of troops worldwide, and they identified very specifically Iran, Iraq, North Korea, and particularly China. They spent a good bit of time talking about China, containment of China. China's the major threat, and making sure that we will always have military dominance and being able to control China. So, and they said that, you know, this is going to be a problem because the American people aren't really tuned into, you know, having an empire and global military domination. And we don't even talk about it like that. I mean, they didn't want to talk about it like that. But, you know, they said that that's not going to happen. And then, of course, the famous words, unless there's a new Pearl Harbor. So they're laying that right out. And, of course, 9/11 gave us that catastrophe to which they were able to maximize this philosophy and continue military expansion and growth. So we looked at who the beneficiaries from this process. You can identify who the people are advocating for global dominance. You look at who the beneficiaries are, and then you start to put the names of the people that run those boards of directors together in a group and as a list. They all know each other. I mean, they go to different meetings and they talk. I mean, these people, if you're on a board of directors of a major defense contractor, you know all the players. And there's not that many. I mean, our list covers about 240 people. And we show the interlocks between the various groups and who they are. So we looked at the key advocacy groups, PNAC being one, but also the Hoover Institute, the American Enterprise Institute, the Hudson Institute, the National Security Council, Heritage Foundation, the Defense Policy Board, the Committee on the Present Danger, the second one in terms of the one about Iraq, the Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs, the Manhattan Institute, the Committee on the Liberation of Iraq. That was during Clinton's administration with Bruce Jackson, and they put together this committee advocating the invasion of Iraq back then. The Center for Security Policy, the Center for Strategic and International Studies, the National Institute for Public Policy, and the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee, APAC. So those groups, those 15 groups, are kind of the core philosophical supporters for the PNAC, and money, too, that went in. And you look at individuals are giving speeches to these groups or people coming out of them doing policy position statements and that. You know, these groups, their core elements are closely interlinked with the top defense contractors in the country. Here's a quote from Condoleezza Rice, and she's speaking at the Hoover Institute in 2000. She's saying, you know, as the world's leading superpower, the United States has special responsibilities. I like to think about this as a great train that's moving down the track. And the metaphors that get used here are interesting. There's markets and competition for private capital. And Rice is saying, clearly, the United States is kind of in the conductor's seat. And with this position of leadership, we have this responsibility for to keep the peace. So, you know, it's kind of quaint, but it's like, okay, we got to have a military that's going to rule the world. I mean, that's essentially what she's saying. And this gets manifested more overtly. We looked at Dick Cheney's speech to the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee, AIPAC, just in March. On March 7th, he gave the keynote speech to the AIPAC meetings. And this is kind of a telling example of the neoconservative global dominance thought in the current administration. Kind of his exact words. Israel and the U.S. and all civilized nations will win the war on terror. And to prevail in this fight, we must understand the nature of the enemy. As America experienced on September 11, 2001, the terrorist enemy is brutal and heartless. The enemy wears no uniforms, has no regard for the rules of warfare. Now, this is Cheney. Is unconstrained by any standard of decency or morality. And the terrorists, now this is the part that's incredibly interesting. The terrorists want to end all American and Western influence in the Middle East. Their goal in that region is to seize control of a country so they have a base from which to launch their attacks and wage war against governments that do not meet their demands. Ultimately, to establish a totalitarian empire that runs from southern Spain, across North Africa, through the Middle East, through India and Pakistan, all the way to Indonesia. This is what the terrorists want to do. And you get the ironic, it's a little ironic. And they're trying to build this. So Cheney, you know, he's claiming that there's all these evil terrorists everywhere. They're plotting for the ruin of civilized nations. And that we've got to stop them militarily by controlling all the regions that they're threatening. So this forward deployment, global domination, is clearly written in there. It's designed, you know, we've created this terrorist enemy. And to prevail over totalitarian terrorists, you know, we have to have U.S. domination of the world. Now, when we look back at this, and the early neocons and that, you know, for the last 30 years, there's been really only about 14 foundations that have funded, been the main funders for these groups, for the Heritage, for the, Hoover's been around for a long time, but AEI. And in the past 30 years, $177 million has gone to fund the policy directives of the global dominance group people. 96% of that money came from 10 families controlling 14 foundations. So we're talking about Scafee, we're talking about Bradley, Orlin, and a dozen others, which we list in our paper and that. So it's a narrow group of funders with some big bucks putting in millions of dollars to key groups. And so we see greater evidence of this kind of conversation.
That was Dr. Peter Phillips, Director of Project Censored, reporting on the conversation among elite groups on global dominance. He spoke at the 9/11 Education and Strategy Conference held in Chicago on June 4, 2006. When TUC Radio returns, Dr. Phillips will speak about the role of public relations companies who increasingly manage not only the images of products and corporations, but of governments and even aspects of certain policies. Here's a preview of Dr. Phillips' presentation in the upcoming program.
You don't hear a lot about the Rendon Group unless you follow war news. I mean, well, they don't like say that they're making the war news, but they do. Rendon Group is the company that has worked since the 80s managing the images of Americans' imperial wars. They worked for Bush. They handled Serbia. The first big one was the invasion of Panama. And so they've shaped the international support for the first Gulf War. They actually created the Iraqi National Congress and handpicked Ahmad Shalabi to be the head of that. I mean, they got CIA money to do that. So the Rendon Group is one that manipulates the news. They're the ones that brought us the pulling down of the statue. I mean, they took the Iraqi National Congress guys, brought them into the to that square right in front of the Palestine Hotel where the media all was after they'd shot a few of them. And that become this image, this of how the war was going and we were winning and how happy the Iraqi people were that we were there and all of this. And that was the Rendon Group doing that. They also did the Jessica Lynch story. So, you know, Jessica Lynch, the heroic rescue, they've got the camera crews following the special forces in to rescue her in the hospital. And that was timed. I mean, that was the day that the tanks were rolling into Baghdad. That's the day we shot the artillery shells in the Palestine Hotel. That's the day we bombed Al Jazeera. And what's on the front page all over the country? Jessica Lynch. That was deliberate. That was the Rendon Group. That was their policies of deception and you know, having stories that lock us out. And we can get a sense of the money involved here. I mean, the Clinton administration in 2000 spent $38 million on 64 contracts with public relation firms. And you go, oh, wow, that's a lot. You know, I mean, that's you're creating the news and stuff. Bush, this is from the GOA report, in 30 months from 2003-04 and half of 2005, spent $1.5 billion on public relation firms and media.
That was a preview of Dr. Peter Phillips' presentation in part two of this talk. You heard part one of The Global Dominance Group and 9/11 by Dr. Peter Phillips, co-written by Bridget Thornton and Celeste Vogler. The Global Dominance Group is based on work done at Project Censored at Sonoma State University. You can find the text of the document at their website, projectcensored.org. That's projectcensored.org. Project Censored tracks the news published in the independent press and compiles an annual list of 25 news stories of social significance that have been overlooked, underreported, or self-censored by the country's major national news media. Visit TUC Radio's website at www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org for a link to Project Censored. Please find a pen to write down a phone number for information on how to order a CD or audio tape of this one-hour talk. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations. Your order of a copy of this program is our only support and is essential in keeping us on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape or CD by mail or credit card by phone or on the web. Our toll-free phone number, 877-TUC-TAPE, translates into 1-877-882-8273. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.